Thank you very much for coming, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to see you here this evening. My name is Sasha Gorob. I'm a lecturer at King's College London. I work mainly on modern European philosophy and also the philosophy of art. I'm also the inaugural director, or my co-director Harold and Braden in the back there, inaugural director of the Centre for Philosophy and Visual Arts, which we're launching at KCL. And I'm absolutely delighted to have with me this evening the artist Alina Azadeh, who we're going to be talking to tonight. As is usual, as has become the tradition in these salons, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on introductions because I'd rather keep the time for talking, but I'd encourage you to take a look at our website, and the links are on the thing that we send around. I'd also encourage you to have a drink here afterwards, partly as a way of saying thank you to Fernandez and Wells for letting us use this lovely space. So, as has happened in the past, Wells is going to speak for about 15 or 20 minutes, then I'm going to maybe ask a few questions myself, and then we'll gradually just bring it into a Q&A. We'll do all this very informally. It should be a really fascinating evening. Thank you again for coming. Take it away.
Hi. It was interesting for me to try to pick some work that would kind of connect with talking with a philosopher. So that's, it had the particular... it was good, actually. And I was... I picked three pieces of work, and I'm hoping that you can kind of draw out threads between them. I work across a lot of different mediums, from sculpture, installation, to performance and film, and digital. So I'm going to talk about a sculptural piece, an installation, performance piece, and then a current piece that I'm working on, which is kind of digital audio work. They're all in some way about this idea of trying to hold two spaces at once, binary, in a single, with a kind of single vision or single framework. And I work a lot with biographical narratives, so this presentation will be kind of, it will be in that mode. So this piece is a sculpture that's currently on show and is touring a few other sculptures. Part of a group called Tall Tales. It's a Swiss Cottage Library Gallery that's going up north and then to Glasgow. And it's called Empty. And it arose from really the original experience was that in 2004 my arts practice completely changed, and it came from a very kind of quite a dramatic life experience and two things happening within 3 weeks. The first was that I became a mother, so I had a child. So I went through that kind of journey of giving birth. And then with my mother present, mother was from Iran, born in Iran. And then within 3 weeks, my mother, when we went off to Phuket to kind of recover from the labor, supporting me in the birth, she disappeared in the Asian tsunami, so she went missing 3 months and then her body was found, so she died. And so it was that liminal space. I was in that space with the works that I made from that of life coming in and then life leaving. And so a lot of the works are kind of around what emerges in that space. So this particular piece came about through a dream that I had a couple of months after she died. I had a lot of dreams, but the particular one was that I was wanting to ask her some questions about what I should do about the memorial. And I went into the kitchen, and she was standing there, and she had a pot. She was cooking. She was an amazing cook. A lot of the pieces in this work are around the language of food and the things that she translated to me, which were all around Sufi poetry. I don't have Farsi, I'm not bilingual, I wasn't brought up bilingually. So I've got to know that culture through the food and through her, what she gave me, which was really the poetry and stories and then trips back to around with her. Anyway, she was cooking and I tapped her on the shoulder and I asked her a question. And she looked at me and she lifted up her cooking pot and she pointed to the inside the cooking pot and there was nothing there, it was just steam. And then she put the lid on the cooking pot and then she disappeared and was gone. And so it was kind of this experience of someone detaching and no longer being your mother, and where does she go, and this whole kind of existential experience that I had. And when I was making this piece, I found this pot to wrap it. I wrap in order to kind of, in a ritualized way, in order to kind of honor and separate from in experiences. And this was a kind of grieving, it was a form of grieving. So I wrapped a lot of her belongings, and I made them into sculptural pieces, and then I made a big piece that I'll show you in a minute. But there was a poem that I pulled out at random when I was wrapping this piece of work, and it's called Empty, and it's by Rumi. And it goes like this. When you are with everyone but me, you are with no one. When you are with no one but me, you're with everyone. Instead of being so bound up with everyone, be everyone. When you become that many, you're nothing, empty. And so I found that as I started to wrap a lot of these objects, poems came forth and were bound around them. And I was blogging and writing about the experiences, and I started to bind them with fragments of my blogs and my writing. So this idea of, you know, the bound and the written kind of became a kind of language that I was using. And it was the first piece where I realised that my biographical narrative, which came from, you know, she died in this very, very public, you know, global event, became a kind of starter feed for a conversation about grief and bereavement and absence and longing. And so what I decided to do was to ask the public whether they too had objects which represented an ending or a loss that they would put into my collection, which was called Gifts. And the first 99 were from my life and from my mother's life, and I wrapped them here. And then this was what was given to me in the course of a year. So the objects were wrapped, and they were ritually wrapped. So around 500 of them were wrapped with people. So there was a conversation, a sharing of narrative from me, and then there was a conversation and a sharing of the narratives that came with each object that were on the wall there from the people donating the object. And then there was a taking of the cloth and a wrapping and a binding, and then there was a gifting into the collection, and a kind of, in a kind of ritualized farewell, if you like, in some sense. And what I found was that objects could, that people were able to speak about their experiences in a much more powerful way through their objects than they were if you just asked them about, you know, to do a story around somebody you lost. And they range from, you know, the trivial to the deeply profound. So there's someone's parents' ashes in there, there are divorce papers, there are first toys, there's a box of night air, there's some poetic stuff. There are the keys to, 37 keys to all the houses someone had ever lived in, all kinds of things in there. And what I found that people were giving me objects and I was giving them emptiness, something like referring to emptiness again. And what I had wanted to do at the end of that is I wanted to burn the whole thing and eliminate it back into nothingness. But this wasn't really approved of by the curators of the museum. It's a museum, so it's all about the impressions of objects. So that didn't happen. But I kept having this desire to materialise things and then dematerialise them. And that came back around. So the second piece I'm going to touch upon, which is called Burning the Books, these are the relics of that piece of work. So there are nine jars, and they're the ashes of nine books of debt, stories of debt that I burned over the course of 3 years. And so this was the first piece that I made. It was in Liverpool, the Blue Coat. And basically, I was in a kind of inquiry into what debt was, because it was in, again, I had a biographical narrative around debt. I had a really intense and devastating experience of financial debt. And I was curious about it because I found it such a powerful debilitating experience, but I knew it was, I knew somehow that there was something that I wanted to understand better. So I went on this kind of research inquiry into what debt was, and I found, going back into mythology, supernatural scribes with the big books in the afterlife writing down and weighing up the good and the bad deeds and what was owed, and then I found the idea of the Jubilee in the holy books, so the idea that in the Bible every 7 years, in the Torah every 50 years, and I think many other religious traditions, there is an element of a writing off, of a breaking of the bonds of the debt, and of a starting again. And so from that emerged the idea of going around with a book, asking people what they thought debt was. So I was expanding my understanding of what debt was through the conversations, and then serving it back as a kind of poetic provocation for then staging these rituals, which were initially just me reading out what I'd been given. Everything from, you know, land rights to huge amounts. I think we burned about £4 billion worth of unpaid debt, to the blood owed to love, care, time, attention, ecological debt, social debt, to debts of gratitude, care and love. So it's again this dual space of good debt and bad debt, and what constitutes one and the other, and how they're often connected. So from going from gift, which can often be a debt in disguise, a lot of those objects that were given were burdened, people who were giving them, so they're imbued with a sense of obligation, and I found that a lot of the debts that were given were often treated like gifts, so people were talking about wanting to repay gratitude, and I found that quite interesting. So there was a duality in the whole concept of debt that was interesting to me. I soon, by about the fourth or fifth book, I was finding that I was able to open up the subject by sharing my story and the stories that were in the book, just to the extent that people would co-recite their stories that they had written either in writing workshops, or about 30% of them came in online anonymously, or they were written into, you know, where the books resonant, like everything from nightclubs to outside a cathedral to museums, art galleries, shopping centres, really across the board. So really crossing borders is where I would take this project, because debt really is ubiquitous, and a war museum as well. So it started to become a collective piece. So again, it's this thing from individual practice to social practice. So this is the Book of Debts in Brixton, which was book 9. And this was with a choir. So in the end, we broke up the provocation at the beginning, which you can watch this online on Vimeo, Burning the Books, is a really good half-hour film to make, edited by someone who's in the audience. And the choir actually sung parts of this, and then they would recite their own debts, and it became a collective piece. So but it was very intimate. Again, it was kind of an intimate space, narrative space, and that's what I think interests me, is how you can bring up a single story, and that can generate, in this case there were about 1,000 stories in the end over the course of 3 years, nine volumes, and how everyone could somehow find something in there that would generate a response to the book, and then they would, it's like a kind of call and response mechanism, this book. And again, materialising and dematerialising. So when the book was burnt, there was the idea that debt is an illusory, is a construct, so we can burn it because actually it doesn't really exist. You know, a lot of people put nothing in my book because they were questioning the idea that debt actually exists, but the impact of this experience of debt was often so real and concrete. You know, there was so much suffering attached to a lot of these stories that something happened in the burnings which was ritualized and often deeply emotional, and that was a surprise to me. I didn't expect that. Something real seemed to happen. And that kind of grew and grew as the project built over the course of 3 years. So again, it's people giving a story and then they'll be giving emptiness in return again. It's this exchange, it's transactional. And then moving, how am I doing for time? Good, yeah. And then from this, I really got interested in this idea of collective narratives around difficult subjects. And again, this idea of, you know, the duality of things and being on one side or another, and how can you really get inside the experience of someone who's got a very, very different perspective from you on a particular subject. And about a year and a half ago, I was asked to attend a series of salons at King's on the subject of conflict and belief, and with the view to devising a collaborative piece of work between an academic, an artist and an activist. And I met an academic called Craig Larkin, who's in the Institute of Middle Eastern Studies, and then also brought in someone else who's a theatre practitioner called Maria Patterson, both who work a lot with Muslim communities in different ways. We've been kind of having conversations for quite a while around this idea of the materialising of war as a listening device and then the dematerialising of it. So maybe an installation, originally it was an installation piece that would go up, be full of narratives in some way, objects, and then would be ritually deconstructed in spaces. We got some R&D funding, and I spent 2 months in the spring doing a residency at a place called Glass Theory, who are an artist group who work with interactivity, both in performance and online, digitally, and they work a lot with interactive narratives. And out of that, I realised that in order to bring something of meaning, I had to look at my own walls, borders, barriers, which is what we were looking at. Stories that would somehow feature walls, borders, or barriers in some way, and that were about this kind of collapsing of dual perspectives into a single space. And so I went back to the very personal. And what this piece now is evolving into is eventually, and will be, a series of installation interventions in different communities who will use it as a kind of listening, dialogical device, but is also an online work, which is a set of stories, interactive stories. And I'm going to read you one of those stories so you understand what I'm talking about, because it's a bit conceptual to sort of describe it. So I went back to, and all the stories are going to be kind of transnational or transcultural in some way. So it's the idea again of how do you step inside the skin of a stranger? How do you see yourself from another perspective? How do you share your subjectivity? How do you defeat the binary them and us, here and there, past and present? How do you collapse that into a narrative space? So I'm going to read this piece, and it's called, it's part one of a two-piece story, but it's self-contained, and it's called The Ancestor War. You're welcome to close your eyes, if it's easier to listen. The idea that it could be listened to from anywhere, so it will be on your phone or the internet, or it might be performed in this way. And it refers back to the story at the beginning that I was talking about around my mother. You're walking through a garden at night. The darkness is an inky blue-green. Can you feel the temperature? It's warm, slightly balmy. As you move through the space, you feel something brush past your face. Leaves and a fruit of some kind. Apples? Pomegranates? You realise you're in an orchard. You seem to be alone, but you don't know this place or what you're doing here. You wander through the trees, looking for something, but you aren't sure what. A sense of urgency to reach the outer boundary of the garden to find a safe border, an edge, overcomes you. You start to run. You see the silhouette of a wall a few metres ahead of you and stop just short of it. Can you see it? It's a very low section which is eroded. It seems to be an ancient wall. You run your hand along it and a crumbly powder comes off in your fingers. You want to jump over the wall, but then as you go to lean your hand on it to raise you up and over, you realise you're barefoot, in pyjamas, and that this is a dream. you startle and you wake up. You have this dream many times throughout your childhood. You never get over the war. 20 years later, you're sitting on a coach on warm blue leather seats, and God is Great in white sticker type on the front wheel windshield ahead of you. It's full of families and a few single male passengers, all with their window shades mainly pulled down to protect them from the midday heat. It's the bumpiest 8 hours you've ever spent riding northwest from Tehran to Namin, a small village near Tabriz in Iran, with your mother. She is trying to read a newspaper and making vociferous political comments at regular intervals. This could make you slightly anxious. She was almost arrested on the last train trip with the same behaviour. But you love travelling with her, just the two of you. Now she's smiling and squeezing you and pointing out the landscape in between. It's your first ever trip to Iran with her, to her hometown, to see where she spent her early childhood. There are so many hairpin bends on these mountain roads, which alarmingly don't seem to have any white lines on them at the edges. And then, at other times, far mountain ranges come into view, fields in parched yellow below. One of them catches your eye, a rectangular field in the centre of a hillside, only the rectangle is black, burned to the edges, but with a crest shape in the middle. Your mother explains this was the crescent of the Shah, etched into the landscape and then set fire to during the revolution. Somehow, it never grew back, it never replenished itself. As you approach the village, you see it's much greener than you imagined. A young boy runs along the pavement, waving at the coach, crying out in excitement. He catches your eye. You smile. Despite the exhausting journey, you are excited, too, to meet a whole section of your family, cousins you only saw in photos as a child, and to visit your grandparents' grave. The coach stops just opposite your uncle's house. This used to be one of your grandparents' houses. They call it the villa. You walk through a big, ornamental, slightly rusty metal gate. You get swept into the house immediately as your uncle, aunt, and cousins come out beaming and talking all at once to greet you both. Light summer chadors and smiles. They take your cases, kiss and hug you, and comment on your massive trainers and invite you to eat. Lunch is a delicious bean, herb, and noodle soup with salty flat bread. After lunch, where you're trying to keep up with what's being said in Farsi, but not managing very well, everyone takes a nap. You really need to sleep too. But after a while, you feel drawn to head outside to the garden. As you walk down the light sandstone terrace steps, you realise this garden is an orchard. And you get a strong sense of déjà vu. You find yourself wandering through it, and then speeding up, searching out the edge of the garden. You see a wall, the wall of your dreams, crumbling and low at one end. You stop, stand, and stare at it, hard. It's as if you are old friends, and you want to have a conversation with it. There it is. There is a strong sense of having arrived in your body and in this place. So the piece will be stories told by people, obviously sourced from different conversations, written in, and they'll all be about 5 minutes long, and they'll all be interchangeable. So that, again, it's this idea of a kind of collective of stories, looking at the idea of wall and border and barrier, but at very different levels. So not just the literal, but the social, the cultural, gender, state. And so that was just one that I wanted to read to you. And I think I'll stop there.